Welcome to Motivation Here Special Edition. I'm Glenn Hodges, your host and founder of Motivation Here and Special Edition. I describe this program as a contemporary audio version of Napoleon Hill's classic book, Think and Grow Rich. I'll introduce in just a few seconds my very special guest today, but I must recognize our sponsors. PromoSherpas.com, your source for stylish and cost-effective branded merchandise, also known affectionately as swag. Elevate your brand at PromoSherpas.com. My best guest today will receive a complimentary delicious gift basket from the Bread Basket, high atop Signal Mountain, Tennessee. The Bread Basket provides an assortment of specialty sourdough bread, breakfast breads, cakes, and cookies. They ship nationwide and can be found on the web at breadbasket.com. My very special guest today is Major Anthony A.B. Burke, the CEO and founder of Mach 2 Consulting. He also performed a very heroic service for our country during what I believe was the biggest security crisis in the history of our country. Welcome to Motivation Here Special Edition, AB.
I feel honored to be included, so thank you.
AB, when you were in school, what was your great big dream?
Glenn, when I was in school, and I think we're going to talk about from high school on in this case, although the dream probably started earlier than that, I had a dream of being a 35-year-old United Airlines captain, F-16 pilot in the reserves, bachelor. I thought that would be the dream.
And looking at your career, it's almost a storybook example of someone living the American dream. Would you not agree?
Maybe it is. I have joked many times that at age 27, I was flying fighter jets, not the F-16. I was flying the F-4 Phantom with the 108th TAC fighter wing out of McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey. I had recently been married. I was getting ready to have my first child, and the airlines would not hire me. And my wife looked at me and smiled and said, you know, batting 333 is pretty good in the majors. And it may have been, to be honest with you, the airlines not hiring me may have been the most fortunate thing that ever happened to me at that point in my life, because it forced me to pursue my other passion, which was starting and building great businesses. And, you know, shortly after that time I got off the active duty, I joined the reserves and actually joined the California Air National Guard, the 144th Fighter Wing of the California Air National Guard, where I did fly F-16s, and was forced to go find myself a real job and got involved in the mortgage banking industry, which went very well, and then somehow got pulled into a low-tech startup out of Southern California, which grew very exponentially. And then that led to starting another business that's way back in 1996, a management training company where we applied fighter pilot principles to the business world. And I've really been in that world ever since.
I think most of the people on this call know a little bit about you, maybe a lot about you. So let's kind of fast forward your career, but yet step back in time. And let's listen to a brief news clip from Peter Jennings, ABC News.
ABC's Peter Jennings is at the anchor desk uptown here in New York and is now in position. Peter, I suspect you are looking at exactly the same pictures. Well, I know you're looking at the same pictures we are.
We are, Charlie. We've been watching it from the beginning. We'll be watching this for much of the day. There is chaos in New York at the moment. There have been not one but two incidents, as Charlie and Diane have so ably reported so far. The second one coming at 9:03, when television was on live and you could see what was clearly a jet aircraft flying into the second trade tower. Both trade towers now, these 110-story high towers, have now been hit.
Anthony, I bet that brings back some very vivid memories for you. Where were you when you first heard about the attack on the World Trade Center?
Wow, Glenn. That listening to that gives me chills, as I'm sure it does to so many of the listeners today. Really almost 15 years ago at this point. The morning of September 11th, 2001, I was driving a rental car to the Burlington, Vermont International Airport. At that time, I was CEO and president of a company called Afterburner Seminars. And on September 10th, I had given a speech to a group of investment bankers up on Lake Placid, New York. And so the morning of the 11th, I was driving to the Burlington, Vermont International Airport because I was catching a 9:30 a.m. United Airlines flight out to Denver where I was going to be meeting with another client. At that time, I was also an F-16 pilot with the 144th Fighter Wing of the California Air National Guard based in Fresno, California, where I resided. And in my spare time, I was also a United Airlines pilot, a first officer based out of San Francisco. So when I got on that 9:30 a.m. United Airlines flight and I walked into the airplane, I instead of turning right, I turned left, as I always did, and poked my head in the cockpit and said, "Good morning, Captain Anthony Burke." F-16 pilot with the one F-16 pilot. I actually told him I was a United first officer based out of San Francisco and just wanted to say hello. I was sitting back in seat 2A. And he turned over his shoulder. He said, "Hey, welcome aboard. Thanks for saying hi. Sit back, relax, make yourself comfortable." I said, "Sir, I will do that. But I just heard the weirdest thing on the radio. I just heard about some guy that flew his airplane into the side of the World Trade Center. Sir, did you hear anything about that?" You know, he turned back over his shoulder at that point. He looked at me and he said, "You know, that's funny. I did hear something about that." He said, "Man, I sure hope that guy's okay." And that was kind of our conversation there. In fact, that had been my exact thought. We would have used the term flap. What kind of flipping light airplane pilot would have flown their Cessna 182 into the side of the World Trade Center, and how bad did he or she get hurt? That was the end of our conversation. I went back. I sat in my seat 2A. I started reading the newspaper, and about 5 minutes later, the first flight attendant came back to my seat and said, "First Officer Burke, the captain would like to see you in the cockpit." It's fairly unusual. I walked back up into that cockpit. I think you know, Glenn, this is a pretty tight space. So now it's me, the captain, the first officer, and the first flight attendant all mushed in there. And the captain closes the door, and he hands me a piece of paper that has just come off the onboard printer. I look at it, and it says, "We've experienced a major catastrophe. We've activated the Emergency Operations Center. Stand by for further words." All of us looked at each other in complete surprise. At this point, none of us could imagine what would have prompted such a message. About 5 minutes later, our flight was canceled. I walked off that airplane out into the terminal. I looked up on the television monitors, and I saw what every single person on this call saw. And my reaction was probably the same as most everyone on this call. I said to myself, "My gosh, what can I do to help?" I immediately picked up my cell phone. I called my squadron commander back in California. I said, "Hey, sir, AB, stuck out here in Burlington, Vermont, just wondering how I could help." He said, "AB, I don't see how you're going to be able to help us out. You're a long way from home, and I don't think you're coming home anytime soon. But come to think of it, there's an F-16 squadron right on the other side of that field in Burlington. Why don't you call up their squadron commander, see if you can help them?" I hung up with him. I immediately called the squadron commander of the 134th Fighter Squadron, the Vermont Air National Guard, based in Burlington, Vermont, actually co-located on the other side of that airport. I said, "Good morning, sir. Major Anthony Burke, F-16 pilot with the 144th Fighter Wing of the California Air Guard. Sir, I'm stuck here in Burlington, just wondering if I could help." There was a long silence on the other end of the line, and then he came back to me and said, "You're an F-16 pilot?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, do you fly the Block 25? Now, this was the exact variant of the F-16 that we flew 3,000 miles away in California. Once again, I said, yes, sir. He said, dude, what size boots do you wear? He said, I've just been tasked to fly a CAP, Combat Air Patrol, over New York City 24/7. I need 12 pilots to do this mission. I've only got 11 here right now. Get over here as quick as you can. I can't perform the mission without you. I hung up with him. I sprinted out to the curb, jumped in a taxi. We sped around the field. I came on to my new base. I was immediately greeted by life support officers who provided me new flight suit, new boots, new helmet, new harness, everything I needed to fly an F-16. I was then brought into the squadron. I met the other 11 pilots. We got an intelligence briefing to try to bring us up to speed on what very little anyone knew at that time about the situation. I then sat down with my new wingman. We had our own briefing, and then just a few hours later, I found myself taking off in a jet that I'd never flown, with a wingman who I'd never met, in airspace that I'd never been to, and yet, Glenn, I tell you, I felt like I was doing it for the 100th time. And I will say this, with all the stress and tension and unknown out there, that is an incredible testament to not just the training, but the standardization of the U.S. military, and now really of NATO, that you can plug and play people anywhere in the world on a moment's notice under the most stressful circumstances and have them performing up to speed at a high level with very short notice. So I think that's pretty incredible. I'll carry on with a few more points that are just kind of coming back to me now. The first one is, I don't know what it's like in your world or most of the listeners' world, but when you are the new guy, if you will, in a fighter squadron, you don't always get the best deal. And it turned out Burlington was not so different because they basically, their squadron commander basically said, so AB, thanks again for being here. I tell you what, I'm going to put you on the 12 to 12 shift. And I looked at my watch and I noticed it was a bit after noon at that point. And I was thinking, here comes. And he said, so what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to get a hotel room. I would like you to go get some rest. And I'd like you and your wingman to come back here at midnight. And you're going to be on from midnight till noon every day. And the way that worked is we would actually show up around 11:30 p.m. We'd come into the squadron. We'd go out and we'd hang all of our gear on two fully loaded F-16s. And then from midnight until 5 a.m. every night, we were on what was called Homeland Defense Alert, which is basically like firemen. We would hang around the squadron, and, you know, this squadron wasn't really set up for this, so you could rest on the floor, you could rest on a couch, but you were basically on alert waiting for the horn to blow. And if the horn blew, that meant you had 3 minutes to sprint out to your jet, put on your gear, jump in the cockpit, start engines, get airborne, and intercept whatever the imminent threat was. Now, assuming we didn't get scrambled during the night, we then had the 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. cap over New York City. So, you know, at 5 a.m., we'd have our own little briefing. We'd start engines and get airborne at 5:30. We'd take a left turn down the Hudson River, fly for about 30-ish minutes, and we'd come over New York City at 5 minutes before 6 to relieve the crew that had been on from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And, you know, you come on, it was me and my wingman flying over New York, and we also had an air refueling tanker flying above us because these were long missions, and there's a chance if you had to use your throttle a lot or burn a lot of gas that you'd have to go up and air refuel. And you probably understand this, Glenn, but capping means combat air patrol. So we were basically flying racetrack patterns, maybe from Midtown Manhattan down to Sandy Hook, New Jersey, watching with our radars, watching with our eyes, and looking and waiting for whatever the next threat might be. And maybe I should just stop right there, Glenn, and because you probably got a few things on your mind.
I'm enjoying listening to this, AB. So your mission may be to intercept the largest passenger plane or possibly an enemy plane.
It was a very strange feeling. I guess I'd say a few things. That's right. The biggest thing was that there was so much unknown, right? I mean, for me and probably for you, I kept thinking to myself, maybe the attacks on the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon were phase one of a multi-phase operation. So what's next? Is there anthrax coming next? Is there a dirty nuke coming in a ship into New York Harbor? Are there large trucks driving on our roads that are headed somewhere to blow up more of our facilities? What's next? How am I going to react to it? How am I going to deal with it? And I guess I would also say that, certainly the morning of September 11th was impactful for me. But the morning of September 12th, which you may remember was a Wednesday morning, I remember flying over New York City at 9 a.m., arguably the peak of rush hour over the greatest city in the world, on a Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And I remember looking down on that city. I mean, this is a crystal clear, beautiful morning. I'm looking down on New York City, and I'm noticing right off the bat, my gosh, there are no yellow taxis going up and down any of these streets. And then I noticed there are not even any cars coming over any of the bridges from New Jersey and New York. There were not any airplanes flying in the sky. We were the only two, in fact, we were three with the air refueling tanker, in the entire airspace, arguably the busiest airspace in the world. There were not even any boats going up and down the Hudson River. All I saw looking down on New York City on that Wednesday morning was a huge smoking hole over the south end of Manhattan. And I don't know any other way to say it, a gray powder, like a dust, that went all, not just into southern Manhattan, into northern New Jersey, central New Jersey, and really into southern New Jersey as far as the eye could see. And I really thought I was looking at a nuclear winter. And I said to myself, my gosh, we've definitely lost the battle here. But I also said to myself, we are definitely going to win this war. And, you know, as I've thought about this over the last 14-plus years, and I hope all of our listeners realize this, it is an incredible testimony, not just to the men and women in uniform, but all the federal agencies in this country and around the world that behind the scenes are thanklessly fighting this war on terrorism every single day, that there has not been another major terrorist attack in our country, in certainly what's become a more unstable world since 9/11. So that's always kind of hit me hard. And to this day, I thank certainly all of the people that flew Homeland Defense missions, but everyone that's been working hard to fight this war.
Thank you, AB, for your part in it. I never thought I'd be talking to an F-16 pilot that had helped secure our country during such a time of need. You had already started a consulting business at the time that you were in the California Air National Reserves. At what point did you have the idea of taking the concepts of peak performance of an F-16 pilot and transferring that to the business world?
Yeah, that's a great question. As life goes, some things happen rather serendipitously. As I mentioned, my dream had been to be a United Airlines captain. I grew up in a household where my father was a United Airlines pilot. He flew 30 years for United Airlines from 1965 to 1995. And for those that are old enough to remember, certainly 1965 to, let's say, somewhere around 1985, maybe as late as 1990, being a commercial airline pilot was a dream job. You know, certainly in those early years, air travel was something you got dressed up for. It was something that people respected. Certainly the pilots were highly respected. They were very well paid. They had a nice lifestyle, work-life balance. And so, you know, basically I grew up thinking that would be the dream. And as I mentioned to you, when I turned 27, I was getting off the active duty, joining the reserves. I applied to the airlines, and they wouldn't hire me, not because I wasn't a good pilot or I wasn't a good guy, but because airline piloting hiring is very cyclical. And at the time I was hiring, they were looking for pilots with 10,000 hours, and I only had about 2,000 hours. And so we just didn't match up. I needed more experience. And so what that forced me to do, I joined the reserves. I started flying F-16s. But when you join a reserve squadron, when you get off the active duty, your squadron commander warmly welcomes you to the squadron and says, you know, looking forward to flying with you, new guy, but go find yourself a real job. And so I got into the mortgage banking world and realized I was pretty good at it. In fact, we were a small firm that grew rapidly, and I became the top producing mortgage banker in the Western United States. And then I started talking to another fighter pilot buddy of mine who was having some success in business on the East Coast. And somehow we both got wrapped up or pulled into a startup based out of LA where we figured out how to sell paint to the Home Depot. And not a super sexy startup like a lot of the startups in that time, but we grew that business from about $500,000 in revenue to $65 million in about 3 years. Pretty significant growth. And what that meant was we grew from having one SKU of paint in two Home Depots in Los Angeles, California, to gaining 40 feet of space in every Home Depot west of Minneapolis, Minnesota, which was 420 stores when we left. And from there, what we started to realize was everything we were doing to grow our business, train our people, to motivate, to strategize, and really to win was the same thing I was doing flying F-16s with the reserves in my spare time. And so from there, we started to think, man, there's a real business model here, and maybe we could pitch this idea to the Home Depot. So we approached Home Depot, told them we had a wonderful training seminar for them. We thought would be a great fit for their culture. And they said, that's great. We'd love to have you come do that. We've got a group of 70 store managers coming into Atlanta in 3 weeks. Why don't you come in and do that seminar for us? And as you can imagine, Glenn, at that time, there was no real formal seminar built. So a lot of scrambling happened in those 3 weeks. We put something together that was, I think, quite effective, and that was an interactive team-building seminar, which lasted an entire day. And at the end of that session, the head of HR for Home Depot came up to us and said, gentlemen, that was the best program we've ever done at Home Depot. We're so excited about it. We'd like you to train all 2,500 of our managers this year. And we'd also like to call the Wall Street Journal because we think the rest of corporate America should hear your story. Now, Glenn, that was all super exciting except for the fact that we weren't real set up for what was to follow. In fact, I think one day I should write a book about how not to start a business because the Wall Street Journal did interview us. And then my partner at the time in Atlanta, who had a, I'm going to call it an office, but it was really a basement with an answering machine on it, down in his lake house, he went on a vacation in Guatemala on a fishing trip, and that article came out in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, it was the front page of the marketplace section. It was a half-page story, and when he got back from Guatemala, that little answering machine that had 16 message capacity, it had 16 messages on it. And from there, we grew that business, which was called Afterburner, Very dramatically. We grew from having maybe three or four of us to 50 men and women fighter pilots who put on management training programs, keynote speeches, team building seminars, corporate coaching and consulting, all around the concept of flawless execution all over the world. In fact, we started licensing our programs to fighter pilots in other countries. So ultimately, we had fighter pilots in other countries wearing their own flight suits, speaking their own language, delivering our programs, but using their own cultures and customs. I served as CEO and president of that company for a number of years, and then sold my interest in the business in 2007. I took a couple years off for a non-compete. I got involved in institutional fundraising for private equity real estate funds. And then in 2009, when that non-compete fell off, I started this current business, which is called Mach 2 Consulting.
AB, you mentioned a term a few minutes ago, actually the name of your business, Afterburner, which is the same initials of your name. Could you give us share with the listeners the meaning of Afterburner for those that maybe aren't familiar with it?
Sure. For anybody that's seen the Blue Angels or the Air Force Thunderbirds or a fighter jet takeoff under heavy loads, Afterburner is the rearmost part of a jet engine, generally a fighter jet engine, that where the flames come out the back. And when you engage afterburner, you are pouring raw fuel into the rear part of the engine, which creates significantly increased thrust. In the F-16, about 40% increase in thrust. So it really accelerates you faster than you thought you could go. And so when fighter pilots are in a hurry to get somewhere or in a hurry to run away, we use full afterburner or full AB. And my name is Anthony Burke. My initials happen to be AB, so that just happened to be the call sign that stuck for me.
How fast is Mach 2?
Mach is determined a lot by temperature, but in round numbers, you could think of Mach 2 as about 1,500 miles per hour.
We've got a lot of entrepreneurs and business people on this program today, and here we're talking about a company named Mach 2 Consulting. We talk about a thrust of 40% using afterburner, traveling over 1,500 miles per hour. That's fast. Now, how can we apply the principles that you use as a fighter pilot in our business?
That's a great question, and there's certainly a number of facets to the answer. I'm going to give you a short one, and maybe we can build on it. I would say if I look at the way fighter pilots operate, and I compare it to the way many businesses operate, there's a difference in that fighter pilots seem to have a strong thrust or a strong interest in continuous improvement. There is a culture of continuous improvement in every fighter pilot's heart, in every squadron, and I would say throughout the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, Marines, the Coast Guard. And for fighter pilots in particular, we drive that culture of continuous improvement through something I call a feedback loop of regular briefing and debriefing. And this can very much be applied to business, Glenn. And maybe I'll just paint it for you. Most of your listeners probably understand these terms, briefing and debriefing. But from a fighter pilot's perspective, we like to say, you know, you could be the best and the brightest fighter pilot in the world. You could have the greatest ideas or plans or tactics in your head. But if you haven't found a way to communicate those great ideas, those great plans, the people who are going to be flying with you, or in our listeners' world, the people who are going to be working with them or for them, then all your ideas will be for naught because you'll be flying solo, and so will your wingman. And that's why when fighter pilots get ready to fly any kind of mission, whether it's a one-hour training mission or a six-hour combat mission, even though we've been planning and preparing for hours, or quite honestly, in some cases, preparing for days for that mission, just before we get ready to take off, just before we get ready to execute, we always sit down and hold a briefing to ensure that when we walk out the door, jump in our cockpits, put on our helmets, and start engines, that we are aligned, that we are flying in formation, and that once again, we are going to execute that mission at the highest possible level. So I introduce and talk to a lot of companies and leaders about this concept of briefing, how fighter pilots use it to drive alignment, to drive better performance, to make sure we're safe every time we get out there. And then I show them how they can use those same exact tools and techniques in their business, whether it's every Monday morning at 8 a.m. to make sure that our team is aligned and flying in formation as we start the week. Maybe if it's a salesperson, maybe it's briefing themselves when they pull up to their customer account, the same customer they've seen 100 times. But instead of just, you know, pulling up there with the radio cranking and the cell phone going and wandering in the office, knowing that it's going to go perfectly, encouraging them to turn off that car, shut down the radio, turn off the cell phone, and spend just 3 minutes by themselves saying, all right, I've been in front of this customer probably 100 times. I know them well, but I want to get it right again today. What's my objective for today's meeting? What are the logistics I need to be thinking about before I go in there? What are the biggest threats or roadblocks that could prevent me from accomplishing my objective today? What are the roles and responsibilities I'm going to use to make sure this meeting flows the way I expect it to and nothing gets missed? And what am I going to do in the event of contingencies? If things don't go the way I planned, how am I going to react? How am I going to overcome those changes? How am I still going to make this a successful meeting? All right, that took me 3 minutes, but now my mind's right. Now I'm ready to go. So that's where this idea of briefing comes in. And then the other thing I really emphasize to business leaders and organizations is this concept of debrief. And Glenn, debrief says, I don't care how good we think we are. I don't care how well we planned. I don't care how good our technology is. The fact is, at the end of the day, at the end of the mission, no fighter pilot has ever flown the perfect mission. And I bet you it's fair to say that most of our listeners would agree that none of them are ever going to have the perfect day, the perfect week, the perfect month, or the perfect customer meeting, engagement, or event. And that's why when fighter pilots are done executing our missions, we always, always, always call time out and hold a debrief so we can learn from both the mistakes and the victories of today's mission, and we can continue to improve as individuals, as an organization, and maybe most importantly, so that we can find a safe way to give our leaders the feedback they need real time so they can make the right decisions to keep our great team, to keep our great organization moving forward.
Anthony, I was listening to an excerpt from one of your many seminars or presentations, and you made mention of the fact that when you were in service, that you went into the debrief, that the name tags went off, were taken off, the rank was taken off, that they were actually Velcroed to the uniform. Could you share the reasoning for that?
That's a great point, Glenn, and probably sounds somewhat unusual to a corporate environment, but you're hitting the nail on the head. The magic of debrief is that debrief is safe. And fighter pilots have a saying, what's said in the debrief stays in the debrief. The only thing that's going to come out of the debrief are key lessons that we learned, and I'm talking about generic key lessons that we learned that we can throw in or roll into tomorrow's plan. And if they're important enough, we'll turn those lessons into our weapons and tactics officer, who will compile them over the course of the month and then share the most important lessons that we learned as a squadron with all of the pilots, again, with the idea of trying to accelerate the experience of everyone. So let me just paint a picture for you what a debrief might look like. You know, Glenn, if you and I went and flew F-16s this afternoon, let's say we had a 130 takeoff, and we were going to be four airplanes, I could be leading the mission. I'm Major Anthony Burke. I'm a mid-level officer that did all the planning for the mission. I'm leading the briefing. I'll be leading the mission, and I will be leading the debrief. You are on my wing, and just for the sake of argument, let's say that you are a lieutenant colonel. You outrank me. But for the sake of this mission, for tactical purposes, since I'm leading, you're number two, and you're going to be the best wingman you can be. Our number three could be a two-star general, somebody who clearly outranks both of us, the ace of our base, the wing commander, if you will. He or she is in the number three position. And then at number four, once again for the sake of argument, we've got a second lieutenant. A brand new second lieutenant, the newest pilot in our squadron, who is now flying with us. The point I want to make is after we land and we come into the debriefing room, which happens every single time we fly, and the door to that debriefing room closes, something magical does happen. Name tags come off our chest, and you're right, they are Velcroed to our flight suits. So we rip them off, we throw them down on the table. Rank comes off our shoulders, and we hold a debrief where there is no hierarchy, and the sole purpose is learning and getting better. So I may look at my flight of four and say, hey, team, great job today. Great mission. I mean, we were bombs on target. We were on time. We were in formation, and we looked good, and we sounded good. Nice job. But, sir, as I look over at my two-star general, number three on the mission, sir, I'm just looking at your tape, and I'm noticing that we are coming home, we're 100 miles off target, and you still have the master arm switch in the armed position. Sir, are you aware that our squadron standards say that we go master arm to safe 50 miles off target? Now, some of our listeners on the call might be thinking to themselves, boy, AB, I bet that's super stuff, and I bet that works great in your fighter squadron. But I'm not sure if I want to take that tack with my president or CEO or even my VP. That feels a little radical to me, and I understand. I get it. But let's talk for a minute about the master arm switch. In an F-16. With the master arm switch in the armed position, if you were to hit the pickle button, bombs could come off the wings, missiles could go flying off the rails, or if you pulled the trigger, bullets could come out the front of the airplane through the gun. However, with the master arm in the safe position, you can mash on those buttons all you want, and nothing will happen. And more radical to me would be to sweep that general's mistake under the rug, or his oversight, if you will, under the rug, and allow that general to fly another combat mission next week, come back over our own base with a few live bombs, forget to put that master arm switch in the safe position, and pickle off a couple 500-pounders right into our officer's club. To me, that feels a lot more radical. Or, more realistically, and I hate to say this for any generals on the line, but it's very unlikely that the general will fly in combat next week. He or she has been there and done that. They've earned their stripes. And if we have a conflict, they are much more likely to be back in the command post somewhere smoking the big cigar, directing traffic. But what about my second lieutenant at the other end of the table? What about our listeners' new hires in their organizations? Don't you think we owe it to those people to try to accelerate their experience as rapidly as possible? Or are we still from the old school that says, you know, Jimmy, when I came here 10 years ago, I learned everything the hard way, and so will you. You'll be fine. Just keep doing whatever it is you're doing and smiling. That's great stuff. Glenn, for me, that's no way to run a business, to run a team, to run an organization with the pace of change and the level of competition we're all seeing today. So I think we have to find a way to debrief, and we have to find a way to make it safe.
Thank you, Anthony. Powerful information you've shared with us. The beautiful thing is not only have we learned a great deal about a guy that I think's a national hero that we should all be indebted to, but we've learned some things that we can apply to our business. Before we unmute the lines, I've got to ask you one more question. Well, probably have a couple more too, but everyone is concerned about success, but also happiness. Is there a correlation, do you think, between success and happiness? And what would, how would you describe happiness?
I think, well, it's a wonderful question, and one I think I have some passion around. First of all, I think we have to define success, and I think in many cases, your listeners or anyone around the world would say success, you know, that translates to money. And I think that's maybe the first block, because success is has many definitions to many people, and I would argue that certainly financial success is a wonderful thing and can create wonderful opportunities and may create happiness for me or for many of your listeners, but it's certainly not guaranteed. And I would say I have many financially successful friends who are very happy, and I have as many who are having many challenges, or when they got there, when they sold their first business for $100 million or $1 billion and bought the yacht and bought the airplane and bought the house in Aspen, shortly thereafter figured out that didn't make them any happier. So I guess my first point on success is important to define what success looks like or maybe should feel like to you. For me, success involves some level of financial security and independence, but much more importantly involves a work-life balance, a great group of friends, and a great family in my life. I mean, those are probably the most important things to me. And I've defined success for achieving my dreams and my passions. I was lucky enough to identify what my passion was with at a pretty early age. Like I said, I had a dream. It didn't work out exactly the way I thought it would. But the fact that I had a dream and was constantly working for towards it, you know, when things didn't go the way I planned, I still got a nice result. And today I feel like I've got a life that is where I have a wonderful family. I have a wonderful work-life balance. I've made enough money to pursue the activities and passions that I love. And hopefully I can give back to my community and my friends and my family in a way that's meaningful. So the short answer is figure out what success really means to you, have some sort of dream, and then go after it and realize that you're probably going to hit a few speed bumps along the way, and it's okay.
Thank you, AB. I got a message. I believe we've got a caller down in Florida with a question. Are you there, Robert?
First, let me say thank you for your service. I, coming from a military background myself, I know how much dedication, how much discipline it takes to provide that type of service and how important it is to the lifestyle that we enjoy in this country. And so thank you for your service.
You're welcome, Robert. Thanks for saying so.
You deserve it. Love the presentation today. Love the concept. And as I said, I come from a military background, so the concepts of briefing and debriefing are very familiar to me. And I think that within those concepts that you do find something lacking to such a large extent in the, you know, several aspects of the business world nowadays, people not understanding the importance of making sure everybody being up to equal knowledge and using each other to, you know, to sharpen your skills against each other and help each other grow and always help each other up instead of keeping information to yourself or not lending that helping hand where it's needed. And I'd like to ask you, I know that you do this presentation with companies and that consultation. What have you ran in? What are some of the largest challenges that you've ran into in trying to help a corporation incorporate this into their day-to-day business.
Yes. So, Robert, I would say most people on first of brush of these ideas have a reaction that says something like, my gosh, I love these ideas. I love this concept. I'm ready to start debriefing tomorrow. I wish my boss were here. I wish my boss was on the line. They need to hear this. I'm just not sure how they would react. My boss has a pretty big ego. And so I would tell those people a few things. The first one is, and you probably know this, it sounds like you've got a great military background, there is no group of bigger egos than you can find in a fighter squadron. And I joke all the time that, you know, some of these guys, hey, I may not be, I may be included in this mix. Some of these guys have such big heads, it's a wonder they can get them through the door. And there is no more hierarchical organization than the U.S. military. But what we've culturally decided as fighter pilots, as I think an entire military, is that, you know, the decisions and actions we make as individuals in a team, we're risking our lives on. And so, you know, the price of not calling timeout and not debriefing can really be pretty significant. And then I get a lot of people coming back to me and go, well, okay, I get that, AB, but that's so different than my business. I mean, you know, at my mortgage company or at my manufacturing business, if we make mistakes, we don't lose our lives. You know, it's bad, but it's not that bad. And I don't know if I totally agree with them, because I found in business that if we continue to repeat mistakes, we may not lose our lives, but we certainly can lose our way of lives. And, you know, you don't have to look that far back in the rearview mirror to remember 2008, 2009, 2010, when a whole lot of people lost their jobs, a whole lot of people relocated, a whole lot of people certainly lost their way of lives because of, you know, the repeated actions and no debrief, particularly around our financial world and specifically maybe subprime in the mortgage lending market. So first of all, I'd say the consequences of not debriefing in business are as high and in maybe even higher than many cases than in the military. The second point I'd make there is, let's say you've got a boss that their ego is too big to debrief with you in an open environment. Well, how about just starting a debrief process where the debrief is one way, where all you're asking for is your boss to get together with you on a regular basis? Maybe it's every Friday at 4 p.m., or maybe it's after key meetings or sales pitches, and just have them debrief you or the rest of the team. Because at a minimum, now we know how the boss is feeling, where they stand, what they like, what they didn't, what's working, what's not. And we've got a group that's aligned and flying in formation behind the boss's goals. That's a win for the boss and a win for the team. The other point I'd make is, even if you can't get your boss engaged in this, let's forget about him or her and let's debrief with our peers so that we're aligned, flying in formation, opening some honest feedback back and forth and continually improving. And the final point I want to make around this idea of debrief is, I'm not suggesting that we eliminate or reduce the boss's, the CEO, the president's authority. In fact, if I'm a CEO, I'm expecting, if I'm doing my job well, I'm spending a lot of time planning with my people, and I'm encouraging them to give me as much input as possible in the planning process. So when I make a decision, because I'm the leader, ultimately the decision is mine, I can make the best decision. I can come up with the best plan to keep us moving forward. But once I have made that decision and I clearly communicate how we're going to execute to my team through a briefing, I expect everyone to execute as hard and as fast as they can. And I don't want a lot of questions. It's time to go. We're going to war. We're executing the plan. The good news is our team should know that there will be a time to debrief. And that's their opportunity to say, hey, boss, I love the plan you came up with. I love what we're doing. But there's a couple things that I don't think are working that I think could be done better or differently. And in that safe environment, we get those gripes, if you will, out. And then we continue to go back to executing and moving forward. So very important that we don't try to develop a culture where we're a commune and everybody can just, you know, share their ideas any old time, because I don't think that works either.
Anthony, I've got another question while we're waiting for some of our callers to maybe compose a question. In a nutshell, we've talked about how you can transfer the skills of a peak performance of an F-16 pilot to the corporate world. You've gone over all the aspects of the brief, the elements of the brief and the debrief as part of the feedback loop. But before you were an F-16 pilot, you had goals, you had objectives, and it seems like, you know, you were pretty successful. You were a soccer player in college, and possibly the competitiveness of sports may have transferred to the business world and to your military career. But in layman's terminology, what would you say A.B. Burke's principles of success are?
If I were to try to distill those down, I was very fortunate, Glenn, to have a great family who both my parents were wonderful role models. I've got three brothers and sisters who are also very supportive. And so I felt that I had a leg up early on by having a wonderful family who raised me in a great community and who, you know, were wonderful role models to show me, a flight path to success, if you will. With that said, if I were to distill down, you know, my principles to finding success, and again, I'm not putting this all in the money jar, it would be, number one, setting some goal, whatever it is, having a dream, setting goals, and going after them. And I think we've seen time and time again, and maybe the airline industry is the greatest example of that. You know, airline pilots used to retire at 60. It was mandatory retirement. It was remarkable how many of these pilots passed away within 5 years of retiring. They'd had a physical every 6 months. They were in perfect health. They could have kept flying for many more years. And yet, if they didn't have a goal after flying and they retired, they seem to lose their purpose in life, and in many cases, they passed away. So have a goal, whatever that goal is, and push for it. Go for it. The second thing I'd say is never discount the power of hard work. Getting up and doing the activities that will lead to success, even though sometimes those are painful, in the end, will always trump natural talent. Fighter pilots are made, they're not born. Great business people are made, they're not born. Great parents are made, they're not born. And doing the activities that lead to success through hard work will get you the results you want. And then I'd say last but not least, and again, this is my personal philosophy, if you can find a way to give more than you get, I think you'll find that you get a 10x return on the giving you do, whether it's giving of your time, giving of your energy, giving of money. You will get more back than you ever imagined by giving. So I think I'll leave it right there.
I think what a wonderful place to conclude it. It reminds me of a statement that a gentleman I had as my guest on the program on July 16, the day that Chattanooga, Tennessee was attacked by one terrorist. And he's the only man in the world with one arm to ever summit Mount Everest. But his philosophy is make others greater. And I think that's what you're saying there, A.B. giving without expecting something in return. Yes, we all have to make a living. We need to, we have to have money, but there's nothing greater than the rewards of giving. It's 12:58. This is a 59-minute program. Any other words of wisdom you'd like to share in this last minute, AB?
No words of wisdom, Glenn. I just want to thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, and I love your enthusiasm and passion for what you do, and I feel honored to be included, so thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor to have you on the program, and as I mentioned, you should be receiving this week a basket from goodies from the bread basket high atop Signal Mountain. They make it's a little bit different than the sourdough bread you buy there in San Francisco, and I failed to mention AB. I'm not sure if you're in your office now, but he sent me a picture the other day. We were briefly chatting. Looking out over the Golden Gate Bridge, so it must be real tough having to look at that scenery.
It's wonderful. I look forward to seeing the basket, and I think I mentioned to you in my spare time I make Pinot Noir on the Russian River, and maybe some of that, those goodies will pair well with a glass of Pinot Noir.
I looked that up, that Russian River Valley Pinot Noir. I believe that's under the Hail Mary label, correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to trying it. Thank you so much. I'd like to also thank Promo Sherpa for sponsoring today's program. And if someone is interested in AB's consulting or speaking engagement, how would they contact you?
You can go to my website, mach2consulting.com. Mach is spelled M as in Mike, A-C-H, the number 2consulting.com.
Thank you so very much, AB. I appreciate it. Thank you for all of the listeners that joined us today. And remember, if you can dream it, you can achieve it. This is Glenn saying, I love each and every one of you, and I believe in you. I'm out of here.